I thought I'd make an impromptu video. I've just come back from my local mosque. I won't say which one it is. And I heard a talk, a very interesting talk on Islam and democracy. The speaker was very educated, very eloquent, and gave a very positive case for Muslims in the United Kingdom to participate in elections and the democratic process. The idea being that if Muslims didn't participate, that would increase isolation of Muslims and that they would suffer the consequences of not participating in the wider society. So he was urging Muslims to get involved in politics and talking about the democratic mechanism which Muslims can, you know, use to their advantage in terms of advancing their interests materially and in other ways. And I thought he made an interesting case. But I was left with a slight sense of dissatisfaction on a number of points, actually. I just wanted to share some of those thoughts. And I'm going to be reading from this book. It's called Remembering God, Reflections on Islam by Guy Eaton, who used to be connected with this mosque. He was a British Muslim for over 50 years. He was also a British diplomat. He was a convert, of course, to Islam, and he's a beautiful writer. Anyway, he's written some very incisive and insightful words on democracy. As an insider, as I say, he was a British diplomat educated in the best schools. He knew Britain inside out, but he also was a Muslim for over 50 years before he died a couple of years ago. But anyway, come to him in a second. But I think that some of the issues I had, and I raised them afterwards in the Q&A session with what the speaker earlier today said about participation in the democratic process in Britain and by extension throughout the West, is that it was, I thought, an overly utopian view, an overly rosy view, because there are certain hard realities which are arguably in the balance sheet of good and bad and pros and cons and advantages and disadvantages. I would think that there are many disadvantages, negative consequences. We must, for example, acknowledge the asymmetry of power that exists. For example, in France, which had the French Revolution in 1789, when they overthrew the monarchy and got rid of the Catholic Church and put it in its place, which is basically privatizing it and extolling liberty and democracy for all. But there, Muslims, even though numerically, I think they're the largest group in Europe, along with Germany, millions of Muslims, they are strictly subordinate to secular liberalism. And it's very difficult for Muslims to articulate from the pulpit or in any other way some fairly basic Islamic teachings, say, on the different roles that men and women have. That's actually completely illegal. Recently, and terribly, an imam in France was removed from his position simply by reciting the Quran and was deported. He was actually removed from the country for that one offence. I kid you not. You can Google it. It happened. This is just a matter of weeks ago. So when it comes to democracy, the price tag is very substantial in some cases. One's expected also to accept the majority view on all sorts of issues, whether it be gender relations, LGBT, for example, and the secularization and privatization of religion. And wherever Islamic views, values conflict with the non-Muslim majority, the expectation often is that Islam would, you keep quiet about it, you just basically ignore it or change the religion, actually, as we're seeing in a number of high profile cases at the moment. This is a big price to pay, I think, for Muslims. Now, there are advantages in the democratic process. You can elect, so someone told me, for example, a very good example, in Oldham, which is a town in England where the far right, this was some years ago, not that long ago, but the far right were gaining ascendancy. And the danger was, because Muslims were not participating in their local elections, the danger was the far right would elect and did elect British National Party, BNP, candidates to the council. And Muslims were not or hadn't been participating in the elections. And the danger was that they would have a very hostile anti-Muslim council that was ruling over them in Oldham. So I can see the case there. And people were encouraged to vote so that these people wouldn't be elected, or at least they would be diluted, perhaps, or minimised. That's a good argument, actually, for participation in the local elections to keep out people who are a threat to Muslim existence, livelihood, well-being, jobs, liberties. Of course, I see that. But on the other hand, the counter-argument would be, for example, with the case of gay marriage, where I think nearly all, if not all, Muslim MPs in Britain voted for gay marriage in Parliament, which is quite extraordinary. And I think they didn't have much choice. There was a three-line whip. The parties, the Conservative Party, the Labour Party and others, made it mandatory for their MPs, who are members of these parties, Conservative, Labour, whatever, to vote for the legislation to make legal, halal, gay marriage. But the point is that's my point. That's the price you pay. And, you know, making halal what is haram, it can't be done Islamically. It's something, and if you participate in that process, that, to put it mildly, is questionable. And I can multiply examples. So I think my quibble with the speaker, who I must stress I have immense respect for. He's an eminent leader and a scholar and a very decent man, but I thought he presented an overly optimistic and perhaps even utopian view of the benefits of participating in the democratic system in the West, which he saw merely as a mechanism that Muslims also could participate. That was his word, as a mechanism that Muslims also can participate with and use to their advantage, to further their interests. And I thought, well, yes, but the price we have to pay is perhaps disproportionately consequential, that we have to also sign up to many other things as a price tag of advancing our own interests. And someone mentioned Canada, I think, where Muslims have successfully lobbied in the democratic system to ensure some rights to do with marriage, divorce, inheritance, that kind of thing. And that's great. But the price is that they also, Muslims now also, have to sign up to all sorts of other agendas, LGBT, etc., which are obviously not compatible with Islamic teaching. And is that a beneficial process if you weigh it in the scales? That's what I was doubtful about. Now, I'm far from saying what Muslims should or shouldn't do in the West. That's for Muslims generally to decide, of course. But I just wanted to kind of highlight my doubts about this apparently simple endorsement of the democratic process, as if there's something, a good thing that we should participate in. I think there are there's a downside to it as well, with costs to the faith itself. Islam itself is asked to be changed, as that's the price tag. Islam itself is to be changed, and we see this obviously in contemporary issues that are bearing down on the Ummah at the moment. So I'm just going to read a few passages from this book by Guy Eaton, published, I think, year 2000. So it was written in the 1990s. But nevertheless, there's still some insights which are relevant. Now, as I say, he's far from being an extremist, this guy. He was very traditional Muslim, shall we say. And he wrote on page 69 of his book, as almost as a parachuting arbitrarily, because there's so many fascinating insights in his book. He says, "Today, the Muslims are urged to embrace democracy and are condemned for political corruption." He means Muslims in the Muslim world, I suppose. "While Western scholars debate whether Islam can ever accommodate the democratic ideal, on the whole, they think not. Democracy, they believe," this is the Western scholars, "is a sign of political maturity and therefore of superiority. Western societies, since they are seen as democratic, exemplify this superiority. So there is one question that has to be pressed home. What precisely is meant by democracy?" And this is key, because I can say I believe in democracy, you can say that, but we mean very different things. So The key is in the definition. So Guy Eaton tells us, if I can get the page open here, "Let me put forward an imaginary Arab who knows nothing of Western ways but would like to learn about them." So this is a kind of a thought experiment. "He is aware that the literal meaning of the word democracy is mob rule, but understands that this is not what Westerners mean by it. He wonders how this meaning has, in practice, been modified. And since his questions are directed to an Englishman, he is not altogether surprised to be told that Britain is the exemplary democracy. He learns that the people, all except children, lunatics, and peers of the realm, send their representatives to Parliament to speak for them. He is assured that these representatives never accept bribes to vote against their consciences or against the wishes of their constituents. He inquires further and is astonished to learn that the political parties employ what are known as whips. I mentioned these earlier on, that's WHIPS, who compel members to vote in accordance with the party line, even if this conflicts both with their consciences and with the views of the people who elected them. And I mentioned actually an example which actually postdates Guy Eaton's book. In other words, it hadn't happened when he wrote this, of gay marriage, which was whipped, so to speak. So people, MPs, were forced to vote the way Cameron, is under Cameron's government, the last Conservative government, wanted them to, which was to legislate for gay marriage. So people are forced to vote for the party line, even if it conflicts with their consciences. So if you were a Muslim MP, you had no choice. In this case, it is not money, but ambition for office that determines the way they vote, because the people want to be in Parliament. But is this not corruption? He asks naively. This is the imaginary Arab. The Englishman is shocked. But at least the party in power represents the vast majority of the electorate. This time the Englishman is a little embarrassed. It's not quite like that. The governing party, he was writing during the Blair era, this was in the late 90s, I think, where the governing party, the Labour Party, had absolute power over its domination in the House, dominance in the House of Commons. But it represents only a minority of the electorate, Guy Eaton says, because it was something like 46% of the people who voted for it, a minority of the electorate. So that is that. Oh, then he turns to an American. So imaginary Arab then turns to an American person and learns with some relief that since he has himself experienced the oppression of absolutism, that the American system restrains the power of the president by that of Congress and the Supreme Court. Moreover, the elected representatives of the people are more concerned with the wishes of their constituents than with the party line. There's no whipping there. This, surely, is a more democratic system. So maybe Muslims should be keener on this. But he pursues his inquiries and soon discovers that election either to the presidency or to the Congress requires the expenditure of huge sums of money, contributed either by business interests or by wealthy individuals. This is absolutely true. I mean, billions of dollars go to specific campaigns to support elections of people in the last presidential elections. He suspects that these contributions may not be motivated by pure altruism. Really, there is, as he has heard it said, no such thing as a free dinner. Even if he is entirely persuaded of the virtues of democracy, he still wonders how this ideal can be put into practice. And this is a very good point that Guy Eaton is making, that you need to be seriously rich to get elected or have some serious business money backing you. And of course, that is, I would argue, a form of corruption, because it's not a level playing field. It's not like anyone can stand. In theory, anyone can stand. In practice, you need huge amounts of wealth to stand. And of course, that is open to corruption by definition. Then Guy Eaton says, in any case, he remembers, this is the imaginary Arab, he remembers from his reading of the prophetic traditions that a man once approached the prophet asking for the governorship of a recently conquered province and was told, because you want this, you are not fit for it. Wow, because you want this office that he'd asked for, the prophet said, you are not fit for it. He assumes, this is the Arab again, not unreasonably, that those who stand for election, whether in the United States or Britain or elsewhere, seek power. long before Lord Acton, he's a famous historian, suggested that all power tends to corrupt and absolute power corrupts absolutely, pious Muslims held this opinion, modified only in favour of those who fear, whose fear of divine judgment and sense of their own unworthiness protected them. He wonders whether the candidate whose persuasive skills win votes is likely to possess the very different skills which good government requires. This seems to him improbable. He would prefer to be ruled by wise men who assume this burden of responsibility unwillingly and dread the moment when they will stand before God and answer for their exercise of power. He knows, however, that this is no more than a dream of perfection, a form of utopianism, and that the Islamic world has not seen such perfection since the death of the last of the rightly guided caliphs, only 29 years after the Prophet himself died. He sees now that what really matters is not so much the system of government, whether democratic or otherwise, but the power of the ruler or the state and the means by which this power may be controlled and limited. And then just a final paragraph from Guy Eaton's book. Just want to share that with you. It's very interesting. The general principle that the laws and customs which govern the community can only be binding if they are derived from the revelation and from the Prophet's example remains as valid now as it ever was. So he's giving a contrasting view here about the role of revelation, the Prophet's example. In the Islamic view, man can no more make laws for himself than he can be judge and jury in his own case. When he attempts to do so, he is prompted only by caprice, that's his own whims, his own fancies, and there can be no lasting stability when the wind of public opinion, constantly changing direction, governs legislation. The Quran says, if the truth were in accordance with their likes and dislikes, then indeed the heavens and the earth and all the beings therein would have been corrupted. If the truth were in accordance with their likes and dislikes. This is a democratic system in some ways. Our likes and dislikes are by nature capricious. In other words, they're very changeable. And the Prophet is reported to have said that paradise is surrounded by things we dislike, hell by things that we like. That is to be expected in view of the human tendency to choose the lowest rather than the highest when deprived of divine guidance. Christians who still accept the doctrine of original sin are likely to agree. Secularism takes the opposite view. Secularism is an essential part, by the way, of the democratic system in the West today. Obviously, in places like France, Britain, everywhere, in the United States, these are, in effect, or explicitly, secular states. Guy concludes the last paragraph from him. The democratic legislator, if he wishes to be re-elected, must go with the tide of public opinion. And public opinion is governed by personal, subjective feelings, in effect by likes and dislikes, just like the Quran has already spoken of. This tide is, in itself, mysterious. This is Guy Eaton's key insight here. This tide is, in itself, mysterious. And there are those who have suggested that there is a kind of psychological virus which spreads through a whole society. It certainly seems as though we catch opinions in the same way we catch the flu. How else can one account for the fact that one generation will completely reverse the opinions, that is to say, the feelings, of the previous generation, approving what was formerly condemned and condemning what was previously approved? Can you guess what example he's going to give? Very controversial. The example he gives is, homosexuality is a case in point, he writes. When I was young, and Guy Eaton was in his 80s when he died, by the way, when I was young, homosexuals were sent to prison. but the general opinion was that they ought to be shot or castrated, believe it or not. Today, disapproval of sexual deviation, even if this disapproval is based on unalterable religious principles, is described as homophobia. Can one really believe that millions of people thinking for themselves, as they are commanded to do in the modern age, have come independently to almost identical opinions on this matter? That would be an extraordinary coincidence. In whatever terms we define the wind that drives such changes in the zeitgeist, there can be no stability in a legal system which responds from day to day only to passing fancies. And there we go. I'll leave it there. There's so much more I could read from this marvellous book, Remembering God, Reflections on Islam. Some have called him the grandfather of British Islam because of his status as a kind of a senior statesman of British Islam. And there we are. So that's the case, some of the case against a kind of overly optimistic and perhaps a little naive participation in the democratic process in Britain and in France and America. It is a deeply flawed system. Whether or not we should participate or not is up to you, of course, to decide. The video here is like a reaction video almost to the talk I heard earlier in the mosque, which I remain nameless, which I thought gave an overly uncritical, optimistic and even naive and utopian view of the costs and the consequences for Muslims for their faith and their religion in these countries where we live, because there is a price to be paid. And I don't think that was acknowledged. And whether or not in the scheme of things, the pros and the cons, the costs and the benefits are for participation or not, is up to obviously us as individuals to decide. There we go. That's my thought for the day. Till next time.